Good morning, BlackRock.
Good morning.
I got an email not long ago from a United States Marine. So I knew this man was no sissy. I was actually in the Navy, which, by the way, stands for Never Again Volunteer Yourself. But this guy was in the Marine Corps, but he wasn't writing me as a tough guy. He was actually writing me as a distraught father. He said, my daughter was the top Christian student in her high school class. She won several scholarships from Christian organizations to go to college. She could take them to any college she wanted to. So she took her scholarships off to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to win the Campus for Christ. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina. Chapel Hill's about 3 hours to our east. I just spoke there last month. But Chapel Hill is extremely liberal. And he said, I sent her off there. About 4 weeks into her first semester, I got a phone call from her. Her words devastated me. She said, Dad, I don't believe in God anymore. Don't believe in God anymore? What? He said, I got in my car. I drove 4 hours that weekend down to Chapel Hill. I sat down with her, and I got nowhere with her. What do you mean you don't believe in God anymore? What happened? And she said, well, there's an atheist professor on our campus who teaches the New Testament class. Yeah, the atheists teach the religion classes there. And he said, we don't even know who wrote the Gospels, and the Bible has errors in it, so, Dad, I'm an atheist now. He said, is there anything I can do about this? I said, have you ever gotten her any apologetics training? That's not saying you're sorry. It actually comes from 1 Peter 3:15, where Peter says, always be ready to give an answer for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. Now, the gentleness and respect thing is hard for me because I'm originally from New Jersey. Okay? But we're supposed to give an answer. We're supposed to give reasons. And the father said, well, you know, I wanted to, but I just never got around to it. Now, question. Do you think that this young woman, by the way, that's not her. But do you think this young woman is typical or atypical of young Christians who go off to college? Yeah, it's typical. About 75% of young people who go off to college, who are Christians, cross denominations, walk away from the church once they leave the home. Now, there's a number of reasons for this, but the number one reason is intellectually they don't know why Christianity is true. We've sent them off without any intellectual justification for their position. You know, by the way, you know the easiest way to get picked off in a war is to not know you're in one. And the culture is at war with Christian values and Christian truth. And if you send your kid off to college or just out in society without any evidence, they might get hammered. But you know what? It's not really that difficult to show that Christianity is true. You only need to answer 4 questions in the affirmative to show that Christianity is true. In other words, if you ask these 4 questions and can get evidence to answer them yes, then you can show beyond any reasonable doubt that Christianity is true. What are the 4 questions? Here are the 4 questions. Now, that is some pretty grooving music, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. That is actually from our TV show, which is on every Wednesday nights on DirecTV Channel 378. How many people have DirecTV? Can you raise your hands, please? DirecTV. One guy in the balcony. Come on, friends, don't let friends watch cable. If you want to get, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, you got to get DirecTV. Actually, that's not true. You can go to our website right there, crossexamine.org, at those times, and watch it streaming live, or you can get DVDs off our website. Or if you have Roku, does anyone know what Roku is? It's kind of like Apple TV. Well, Roku, it's the NRB network, National Religious Broadcasters. Check it out at those times. We're also on radio every Saturday morning. If it's not on in this area, it's podcasted. It's on our app. By the way, we have a free app, Cross-Examined, in the App Store, 2 words. Almost 80,000 people have downloaded it. They're finding it helpful. So download that app for free, if you would. It's got all the radio programs on there, and also a quick answer section, which will help you interact with others. Now, by the way, why are these the 4 questions? Truth, God, miracles, and the New Testament. Well, look, if there is no truth, If things are just true for you but not for me, or all truth is relative, then quite obviously the Bible can't be true. Of course, if there is no truth, then any book written by an atheist can't be true either. Right? We're going to deal with that question this morning. Second question, does God exist? You can't have a word from God if there's no God. If there's no God, throw the Bible away and every other book that talks about God. But I hope to show you this morning that there really is a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent, sustaining creator out there. We're going to look at three arguments. We'll start looking at them this morning. We'll finish them up tonight. Three arguments for this being. And we're going to see that this being we call God actually exists. Third question is, are miracles possible? Obviously, the Bible can't be true if miracles are not possible. But I hope to show you this morning and tonight that not only are miracles possible, but the greatest miracle in the Bible has already occurred and we have scientific evidence for it. Then and only then can we get to the key question, is the New Testament true? The New Testament doesn't have a prayer if there's no truth, no God, or no miracles. But if truth exists, God exists, and miracles are possible, then we can see if we have an accurate, historically reliable account of miracles occurring to Jesus and his apostles as recorded in the 27 handwritten Greek manuscripts we put under one binding we now call the New Testament. Did these documents tell us the truth, or were they written down much later by religious zealots who embellished it? You know, they made it up, because you know you can't trust religious people. Now, some of you are looking at that going, wait, what about the Old Testament? Do you believe the Old Testament's true? Well, look, if the New Testament's reliable, you get the Old Testament thrown in. Why? Who's in the New Testament that can authenticate the Old Testament? Jesus, right? If Jesus really is God, as the New Testament documents claim he is, now that's a big if, but if he really is God, whatever God teaches is true. Jesus taught the entire Old Testament as the Word of God, so if the New Testament's just reliable, you get the Old Testament thrown in. Now, actually, there's a lot more detail than this, than what we can even do today. In fact, this book goes through 12 points that show that Christianity is true. These are the main four. There's no way I can get through all the material in the time we have here today. The book is 448 pages. Well, actually, I probably could because I'm originally from New Jersey. Okay? I speak at 150 words a minute with gusto 350. So if you can't keep up, the books are available on the book table, as well as a 12-part DVD set that goes through all this thing. And by the way, I want to point out that all the proceeds from the sale of the books and the DVDs will go to feed needy children. Mine, okay? Just so you know, I've got three sons, so I need some help. Actually, the sons are all grown now. As I mentioned, I was in the Navy, but my two oldest sons, when they were interested in graduating from high school and going to college, they thought they wanted to go in the military, so they said, hey, Dad, we want to go in the military, what should we do? I said, look, if you want to fight, go Navy. Wherever there's a problem, we bring our airport right there, we take care of it. But if you want a nice life, go Air Force. So they went Air Force. The oldest one is an intel officer. He spent a year in Qatar, now he's down in Augusta, Georgia. The second son is a KC-10 pilot, which KC-10 is a refueler, so he goes up and refuels other planes. And so our joke around the house is what Spencer does every day is he flies up to 30,000 feet, he sits around all day and passes gas. That's what he does. And the third son is an engineer in Birmingham, Alabama. We live in Charlotte, North Carolina. So my wife and I are now empty nesters. Yeah, it took us a while to get used to that. About 10 minutes. Do we have any empty nesters in here? Yeah, you notice how clean the house stays when they're gone? I mean, we love our kids, but they're messy, all right? Anyway, this PowerPoint presentation I'm about to go through and go through tonight, I want to send to you for free. If you just go to this website, crossexamine.org/CP, that stands for college prep because we do a lot of work with college students. If you send us your email address, I'm going to send you this PowerPoint presentation in a PDF format. You're not going to be able to keep up because I'm going to go quickly here, so if you want it, just type that into your browser, send us your email. We're not going to give your email to anybody else. We're just going to send you this PDF. So if you're interested in that, you can do that. And by the way, tonight, if I time this whole thing just right, we're going to have absolutely no time for questions. No, tonight we're going to have time for questions. We're going to start at 7. Well, music's going to start at 6, right? Am I right, Steve? Music starts at 6. I'll start at 7, and we'll go through the rest of this material, and then we'll take questions, all right? But this morning, we've got to start right here at point one. Does truth exist? You guys ready to go? All right. Now, whenever you start talking about truth, you always have to start with Jack Nicholson. Right? Because Tom Cruise had him on the witness stand, and he said to him, Colonel, I want the truth. And Nicholson said, that wasn't too bad, actually. That was better than the 8:30. But I think you guys can do even better. Colonel, I want the truth. That's right. Well, there's a lot of people that can't handle the truth. They're saying, you got your truth, I got my truth, there is no truth, all truth is relative. If you don't get anything else out of what we talk about here today and tonight, if you just get this one idea down, it's going to be worth your time. In fact, well, this one idea I want to share with you right now, I did not learn until I was 33 years old. I already had a master's degree, and I didn't know this, to show you what a doofus I was. This is the most important thinking skill you will ever learn, especially in our culture today. Because if you learn how to do this, you're going to be a fearless apologist, somebody who can defend the Christian faith. And here's the idea. If someone were to ever say to you this, there is no truth, you should ask that person a question. What should the question be? Say, there you go. Who's back there? Is that you, Mom? All right, you were here at 8:30. There you go. Yeah, what you say is that true? See, the thinking skill here is to turn the claim on itself. This is known as a self-defeating statement. It doesn't meet its own standard. It violates the law of non-contradiction. What's a self-defeating statement? A self-defeating statement is like saying, I can't speak a word in English. You know, what would you say if I said I can't speak a word in English? You just did. A self-defeating statement is like saying my parents had no kids that lived. Or my brother is an only child. Okay? These are self-defeating statements, and they're all over our culture. So when somebody says there is no truth, you should ask that person, is that true? Apply the claim to itself. Now, we call this process of turning a claim on itself, we call it the roadrunner tactic. In the book, you can get the book to figure out why. But with this one little tactic, you look like a super genius. How about this? You hear this quite a bit. There's no such thing as absolute truth. If someone were to ever say that to you, you should apply the claim to itself and ask that person a question. What should the question be? Yeah, simply say, is that an absolute truth? Or if you want to have fun, you can say, hey, are you absolutely sure? See, this is an absolute truth claim claiming there are no absolute truths. Can everyone see this is self-defeating? It's like saying I can't speak a word in English. Once again, you look like a super genius. This one is my favorite one, though. It's true for you, but not for me. Has anyone ever said this to you? Oh, Christianity may be true for you, but Buddhism's true for me. What would you say to somebody who said this? This, I can't believe Mom comes to everything that I do. Yeah, you simply say, is that true for everybody? Is true for you, but not for me, true for everybody? Because if true for you, but not for me, is true for everybody, then true for you, but not for me, can't be true because it's true for everybody. Did I say that right? I know that can give you intellectual constipation if you think about it long enough, but that's because it's self-defeating. It's like saying I can't speak a word in English. Actually, there's a more fun way of dealing with this. If somebody says it's true for you but not for me, say, sure, go try that with your bank teller. Yeah, go to your bank teller one day and say, look, the economy's down. I need some extra money. I'd like $100,000 out of my account. It's very easy to get the money. You simply look back at him and you say, or the teller says, you only got $46.12 in your account. It's easy to get the money. You simply say, that's true for you but not for me. Give me the 100 grand, right? Are you going to get the money? No, if it's true there was only $46.12 in your account, that's true for all people at all times in all places when referring to your account at that time. It's just true. Or suppose you're going a little fast down the Hutchinson Parkway over here. You're going 90 in a 55. Cop sees you, pulls you over, walks up to your car, knocks on the glass, you put the window down. He goes, you were going 90 in a 55. Never fear. Easy to get out of a ticket. You simply say, ha, that's true for you but not for me. And you speed away. He can't give you a ticket if it's not true for you. No, if it's true you were going 90, that's true for all people at all times in all places when referring to you at that time. It's just true. I go to a lot of churches. I normally ask them, I say, do you believe this book is true? And most people will say yes, and then I'll ask them why. Do you know what answer I get more than any other, unfortunately? Because I have faith. Is that a good answer? Does your faith change whether or not this book is true? Does your faith change whether or not God exists or Jesus rose from the dead? No, of course not. I mean, do you have to believe something to make it true? Do you have to believe in gravity to stay on the ground? Do people who don't believe in gravity float away? Hey, look, there's another one. Hey, if you believe, you'll come back. No, that's not the way it works. You say, why is the Bible always talking about faith then? Because there's two kinds of faith. There's belief that, and then there's belief in. Belief that is getting evidence that God exists, that Jesus rose from the dead, that the Bible is true. Belief that is intellectual. It's getting evidence, apologetics, trying to figure out if this stuff is true. But belief in is after you know that it's true, trusting in Jesus for your salvation. See, most of the time when the Bible's talking about faith, it's talking about the second kind. Trust in. After you know that it's true, trust in. In fact, one of the only theological comments that the Apostle John, in fact, any of the gospel writers make, is in John chapter 20. Most of the time, they're just reporting, here's what Jesus said, here's what Jesus did. In John chapter 20, John says, and these things were done so that you may know that Jesus is the Christ, and by trusting in him, you can have salvation. You see, there's belief that and belief in one verse. Belief that is intellectual, belief in is volitional. In fact, marriage is a good illustration of belief that, belief in. When I first met my wife, about 30 years ago, I got evidence that she would be a good wife. But all the evidence in the world didn't make her my wife. I had to take a step of trust in her to ask her to be my wife. And in a momentary lapse of judgment, she said yes. See, that's the difference between belief that and belief in. Don't buy into this idea that Christianity is blind faith. It's anything but. You know what blind faith is? Atheism. In fact, we'll talk more about it tonight. Belief in, or I should say, believe that is evidence. Belief in is the heart. Belief that is intellectual. Belief in is more volitional. And if you don't want to believe in God, you don't have to. You don't want to believe in Christ, you don't have to. God will not force you into heaven against your will. In fact, we'll talk more about that tonight. So this is even probably a bigger one than that. You ought not judge, especially if you're a Christian. You may hear somebody say, hey, Jesus said don't judge. Why are you judging, you hypocrite? You've probably heard this, right? Well, first of all, logically, what's the problem with this claim? You ought not judge. It's a judgment. So the next time somebody says you ought not judge, put your hands on your hips and say, then why are you judging me for judging? And say it just like that with a lot of snark. It makes it more fun, okay? Now, by the way, did Jesus say don't judge? No, what did he say? We got to read the whole passage. Yes, Matthew 7:1 says, judge not, the atheists usually stop there, judge not, lest you be judged. By the same standard you judge others, you'll be judged by that standard. So before you try and take the speck out of your brother's eye, take the log out of your own eye first, then you'll be better able to help your brother. Is Jesus telling us not to judge here? No, he's telling us to take the speck out of our brother's eye. That involves making a judgment. He's simply saying, get that problem out of your life first so you can better help your brother. It would be complete suicide to say, don't make judgments. Everybody makes judgments. You made 100 judgments this morning just getting over here. Judgments between right and wrong, good and evil, safe choices from dangerous choices. Atheists make judgments. What do they judge? There's no God. They judge you're wrong. Jesus isn't the Savior. There is no objective morality. We're all just molecular machines. Those are all judgments. Muslims make judgments. Buddhists make judgments. Agnostics, even agnostics make judgments. They judge there's not enough evidence. That's a judgment. Everybody makes judgments. The only question is, are your judgments true? Jesus, however, did save a very stern rebuke for people who were judgmental. And who were the judgmental ones in his day? Pharisees. And who were the Pharisees? What was their job? They were the religious and political leaders of Israel. And Jesus went after them. Are you telling me Jesus got involved in politics? Yes! The political leaders of Israel were the Pharisees on the Sanhedrin and the Sadducees. He went after them. And by the way, he wasn't so nice doing it. You ever hear somebody say, oh, that guy is such a saint. He's never said a bad word about anyone. If that's the definition of a saint, Jesus was no saint. All you need to do is go to Matthew chapter 23. What does Jesus say in Matthew chapter 23 to these scribes and Pharisees? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Oh, you look great on the outside. You're whitewashed tombs, but on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. You go a mile to make a convert, and then once you make them a convert, you make them twice as much a son of hell as you are. How will you avoid being condemned to hell? What? Sweet and gentle Jesus said this? Yes, Jesus was not Barney.
Can't we all just get along, boys and girls?
No! He was not Mr. Rogers. Can you say kindness, boys and girls? Well, he was kind most of the time, but he certainly didn't go around saying, this sermon brought to you by the letter Q. No, Jesus was tough. And sometimes you gotta be tough. Sometimes you gotta tell people directly. Which is nice, because I'm from New Jersey. I like doing that. Don't you like telling people stuff directly? Jesus did quite frequently. But we have to do it without being judgmental. In fact, somebody put it this way. Evangelism is just one beggar showing another beggar where the food is. I noticed one other thing lately about judging. You ever notice when you compliment somebody, they never get upset? Complimenting somebody's a judgment. When you compliment somebody, it's a judgment, isn't it? Like if I were to say to Pastor Steve, Pastor Steve, you're what a great pastor, man. Look at this church. Great people, great facility. You're doing a lot of great work in the community. I think he's going to say, who do you think you are? You're judging me? You think you're worse than me? He's not going to say that. Right? See, I've noticed that people really don't have a problem with judgments because they love compliments. They just have a problem with judgments they don't like. In fact, if you say something that's true to somebody and they get annoyed, you just convicted them and they don't like that. As Augustine famously said, we love the truth when it enlightens us, we hate the truth when it convicts us. So if you say something and they get annoyed, you're over the target. You always get more flack when you're over the target. You ever notice that? So there is truth out there and you can know it. And everybody makes judgments. In fact, let's sum this whole thing up. The truth about truth. Contrary beliefs are possible, but contrary truths are not possible. You can believe everything's true, but everything can't be true. You can believe the earth is flat if you want. It won't make it flat. And objective truths can't be denied without being affirmed. Suppose somebody says there are no objective truths. What should you say to them? Use the roadrunner tactic. Say, is that an objective truth? If they say yes, well, they've just defeated themselves that there are no objective truths. If they say, no, it's just my subjective opinion, it's just in me, the subject, you should say, then why should I believe it? You see, you can't get away from objective truth. Actually, you can get away from it. How do you get away from it? Just temporarily you can get away from it. You suppress it. That's what the Apostle Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1, that we suppress the truth and unrighteousness to go our own way. In fact, Pascal put it this way. He said, people invariably, almost invariably, arrive at their beliefs not on the basis of proof, but on the basis of what they find attractive. A lot of college campuses I go to, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist on college campuses quite frequently. And I was at University of Michigan the other night. Hopefully we're going to get one here at Yale soon. And we do, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. And when you call it that, everybody shows up. Christians and atheists, and during the Q&A, I'll normally ask atheists a question. And this is the question I think you should ask anybody who's not a believer, especially if they demonstrate a little bit of hostility. I'll usually stop and I'll say, hey, wait, can I ask you a question? Yeah, sure, go ahead. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? Do you know how many atheists I've had in recent years yell back at me, no! No? Wait. I ask you, an atheist, supposedly a beacon of reason, never mind if atheism's true, reason doesn't exist. Why? Because if atheism's true, if we're just molecular machines as the atheists say we are, we're not really reasoning anyway, we're just reacting. But let's leave that aside. If I ask you if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian and you say no? How's that reasonable? How's that rational? It's not. The problem isn't here, the problem's here. They don't want it to be true. You see, most people are not on a truth quest, we're on a happiness quest. We're going to believe whatever we think's going to make us happy. This is what Pascal's saying. The problem is that over the short term, you can do a lot of sinful, stupid stuff that will make you happy, but over the long term, it is a disaster. The only way to get true joy and happiness is to go straight through truth. And Jesus is the truth. So ask people that question. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? By the way, the atheist could ask me the same question. If atheism were true, would I become an atheist? My answer would be yes. The problem is there's no way to know atheism's true if it's true. Because atheism takes away all the tools necessary to learn truth. Again, if we're just moist robots, molecular machines, as the atheists say we are, why should we believe anything we think? But we'll talk more about that later. The point here is that there is truth, and you can know it. And quite frequently, oh, by the way, one other thing. Normally you don't say this in church. Don't worry, Steve. In many cases, the issue is not evidence. In fact, the elephant in the room on a college campus and the elephant in the room maybe in our own lives and certainly outside these doors, the elephant in the room is not evidence. You know what the elephant in the room is? The elephant in the room is morality and accountability. That's the elephant in the room. People don't want it. They don't want there to be God because they want to be God. They want to do their own thing. In fact, if I drill down a little bit further, the elephant in the room is really sex. That's the elephant in the room. You notice all our cultural debates? All over sex. Sex is the new religion. It's an old religion resurrected. Sorry for that cheery news. Let's move on. Okay. So there is truth. The question is now, what is true? If our reasoning has been good to this point, we've just defeated what we call relativism and postmodernism. They can't be true. Why? Because they say it's true that there is no truth. But now we want to see if it's true that God exists. And what do we mean by God? We're talking here about a theistic God, a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator who sustains the universe. And three arguments that we give for this being. The first argument is from the beginning of the universe, known as the cosmological argument. Cosmological comes from the Greek word cosmos, which means world or universe. It says if the universe had a beginning, it must have had a beginner. The second argument is the argument from design, known as the teleological argument. Telos is a Greek word meaning design or purpose. It says if there's design in the universe and design in you, there must be a designer. We're going to look at some of that evidence here tonight. The third argument is not scientific at all. It's more philosophical in nature. Yet it's the argument we've all known since we were very small children. And it's the argument from morality, known as the moral argument. And it says if there's one thing morally wrong out there, like it's wrong to torture babies for fun, or it's wrong to murder 6 million people in a Holocaust, or if it's wrong to go in a theater and execute 100 people, then there has to be a God. Why? Because if there is no God, then all of those things are just a matter of opinion. It's just your opinion against a baby torturer's opinion. It's just your opinion against ISIS's opinion. It's just your opinion against Hitler's opinion. We all understand certain things are really right and certain things are really wrong. If that's the case, God exists. Why? Because God's nature is the standard of goodness. If there is no God, there is no standard of goodness. It's just us, just a matter of opinion. But let's start here at the first argument. We'll get to the moral argument hopefully tonight. Let's start with the cosmological argument. And this is the argument that says, that many people think anyway, points back to the big. Now some of you are going, Frank, you know we're Christians in here, we don't believe in a Big Bang. You guys don't believe in a Big Bang? I believe in the Big Bang. I just know who banged it. In fact, the evidence for the Big Bang is quite good. You even have atheists admitting the evidence. Stephen Hawking, one of the most famous atheists in the world, says this: almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. That space, matter, and time had a beginning out of nothing. What is nothing? Aristotle had a good definition of nothing. He said, nothing is what rocks dream about. That's nothing. No space, no matter, no time. The universe came into existence. Alexander Vilenkin, a Russian cosmologist who teaches at Tufts University. By the way, a cosmologist is not somebody who puts on your makeup. Cosmologist is somebody who studies the origin of the universe. And Alexander Vilenkin said this: with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is now no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Now, this guy is an agnostic who believes in the multiverse. You know what the multiverse is? That maybe there are other universes out there, thousands, millions, billions of universes out there, and ours just appears to be designed, even though it really isn't. It's the luck of the draw. We happen to get one that's designed, but it's not really designed. Well, Vilenkin admits, even if there are other universes out there, and there's no way to prove there are, but even if there are other universes out there, the whole show, all the universes together need an absolute beginning. So it seems to me, anyway, that doesn't get rid of the need for a beginner, right? There has to be an uncaused first cause out there. There has to be what Aristotle would call an unmoved mover. A cause out there that has no beginning, that just is, that gives rise to everything else that is created. So the atheists are admitting the evidence. What's the evidence? That space, time, and matter had a beginning out of nothing. I'm not even going to give you the evidence. It's not even controversial. It's all in the book if you want to read about it. I just want to jump to the bottom line. Here's the bottom line. The bottom line is this. If the universe had a beginning, then it must have had a beginner. The evidence leads us to one of the following two options. Either no one created something out of nothing, which is the atheistic view, or someone created something out of nothing, which is the theistic view. Now, my only question is this. Which view is more reasonable? That no one created something out of nothing, or that someone created something out of nothing? What do you think? Yeah, number two. Actually, at Texas A&M a few years ago, one atheist said, oh, I think number one's more reasonable. I said, number one? Hey, let's look at number two again for a second. Number two says, someone created something out of nothing. Now, that's a miracle, right? But at least you got a miracle worker. You got someone. Number one is a miracle with no miracle worker. That's clearly absurd. How do you get a miracle with no miracle worker? In fact, I said to the audience at Texas A&M that night, I said, to show you how seriously we all take the law of causality. No, by the way, this is very important. The law of causality does not say everything has a cause. The law of causality says everything that comes to be has a cause. Everything that has a beginning. As I just mentioned, there has to be an uncaused first cause. It's either the universe or something outside the universe. There has to be something that just is, that gives rise to everything else. You can't go on an infinite regress of causes. There has to be an uncaused first cause. By the way, this answers the question, who made God? Nobody. He's unmade. He is the uncaused first cause, if he exists. So the question is, how did the universe come into existence, and did it have a beginning? The evidence shows it had a beginning. The question is, what brought it into existence? So I said to the audience that night, I said, to show you how seriously we all take the law of causality, that everything that comes to be has a cause, and that things don't pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause, there is nobody sitting in this auditorium here tonight who is currently worried that as you sit here, a hippopotamus has appeared out of nothing in your dorm room and is currently defecating on your pillow, right? You don't worry about that. In fact, you're not worried right now that a raging rhinoceros is going to appear out of nothing, by nothing, right here and ram into the audience, right? You're not worried about that. You're not worried that things are going to pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause. Then why are the atheists saying the universe can pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause? And if things can pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause, why doesn't everything do so? Why don't Mercedes Benzes pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause? Why don't churches like this could have saved you a few bucks, don't you think? Why don't MacBook Pros pop into existence out of nothing, by nothing, without a cause? Could have saved me $3,000 right there. When you go home and want to have lunch today and you're hungry for a pizza, does it make sense to order one? Or should you just sit there, wait, and hope? I mean, talk about faith. It's the atheists that have all the faith. So, look, if space, time, and matter had a beginning, what must have caused it? Whatever caused it has to be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. Why? Because space, time, and matter had a beginning. It can't be made of space, time, and matter. Also must be intelligent, because the universe is fine-tuned, as we'll see here in a minute. Also must be personal to choose to create. Also must be powerful to create the universe out of nothing. Now, question, when you think of a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, intelligent, personal, powerful cause, who do you think of? That's what we mean by God. Now, the universe just didn't explode into being randomly. It exploded into being with extreme precision. And this is what the design argument tells us, also called the teleological argument. Tonight, we're going to see some evidence that you are designed. But right now, I want to talk about the evidence that the universe is designed. This is sometimes called the fine-tuning of the universe. Fine-tuning. The universe is so precisely tweaked that if you were to change any one of a number of factors about the universe never would have arrived at its current state. There would be no life. There might be no chemistry. There might be no universe. In fact, this is what Stephen Hawking, the atheist, has said. He said, if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in 1,000,000,000,000, a second after the Big Bang, the universe would have collapsed back on itself or never developed galaxies. If you were to change the expansion rate, that infinitesimal amount, we wouldn't be here. In fact, fact, the expansion rate right now is fine-tuned. So the universe wasn't created and then left. It wasn't created randomly. It's created and guided. There's a intelligence out there that creates and guides the universe. What does it say about Darwinism, by the way? Nothing. But sometimes I hear atheists saying, well, look, if macroevolution's true, there's no need for a creator or a designer. Nonsense. Before you ever get to biology, you need a creator and a designer. This is long before biology. You've got a fine-tuned universe, to say nothing about macroevolution. Even if it were true, you wouldn't get rid of the need for a creator and designer. It's not, but even if it were, you wouldn't get neither of a creator and designer. The universe is fine-tuned from the very beginning and remains fine-tuned right now. In fact, the gravitational force, if it were altered by more than one part in 10 to the 40, we wouldn't be here. What's one part in 10 to the 40? That's one part in 1 with 40 zeros following it. You say, Frank, I can't get my head around that number. I know, neither can I. Let me give you an illustration. Take a tape measure and stretch it across the entire known universe. That's a long way. Set the gravitational force at a particular inch mark on that tape measure. I realize gravity is not measured in inches, but this is just to give you a scale idea in your mind. If you were to move the strength of gravity 1 inch in either direction, we wouldn't be here. Across a scale as wide as the entire known universe. There's only three possible explanations for that value being where it is. Physical necessity. It had to be there. No, it didn't have to be there. It could have been here, it could have been here. It could have been a trillion miles that way or a trillion miles that way. Chance. It just so happened to fall there by accident. I don't have enough faith to believe that. By the way, when scientists use the word chance, what do they really mean? Is there a causal force out there known as chance? You know, what caused this? Chance, he was just here. No. What do they mean when they use the word chance? I mean, chance is a word we use to describe mathematical possibilities. You know what they really mean when they say, well, it got here by chance? What they mean is, we don't know. The third possibility after physical necessity and chance is design. Somebody designed it to be right where it is. That seems like the best explanation to me. The same being that created the universe out of nothing designed it to be exactly what it is right now so we could be here. By the way, the same thing is true in terms of design regarding our solar system. The solar system appears to be designed with us in mind. Where are we in the solar system here? Right there, third rock from the sun. If we were just a little bit closer to or a little bit further away from the sun, we wouldn't be here. A little bit closer to, we'd burn up. A little bit further away, we'd freeze. We are what scientists call the Goldilocks zone. It is not too hot. It is not too cold. It is the axial tilt, 23.5 degrees. Change that slightly, we don't exist. Earth rotation, 24 hours. Change that slightly, we don't exist. Oxygen, 15%. Or right now it's 21% in our atmosphere. If it were 15%, we'd all suffocate. If it were 25%, spontaneous fires would break out. If Jupiter was not in its current orbit, we wouldn't be here. Why not? What does Jupiter do for us? Yeah, how so? Yes, Jupiter's gravitational force is so strong that it attracts most of the meteors and space junk to it rather than us. In fact, if you take a close-up look at Jupiter, you know what these purple marks are? Those purple marks are comet fragment strikes that are bigger than the Earth. Thank God for Jupiter. Because if Jupiter wasn't there, we wouldn't be here. In fact, you want to see the size of Jupiter? Check this out here. There's Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Earth. Look at poor Pluto down here. You know, Pluto recently has been demoted as a planet. I don't know about you, but I think it's size discrimination. Take a look at this. You can hardly see Pluto. Take a look at this. That's Arcturus, another star in our galaxy. Here's the sun over here. Jupiter is one pixel in size on this scale. Earth is invisible. Pluto? Forget about it. Now keep an eye on Arcturus. You got Arcturus there? Where is Arcturus now? Right there, left of the white star, Regal. That's Antares, another star in our galaxy. The sun is one pixel in size on this scale. Jupiter is invisible. Earth, Pluto, forget about them. In fact, if the Earth was the size of a golf ball, Betelgeuse here would be 5 or 6 Empire State Buildings high. The heavens are awesome. This is just in our galaxy. This is not outside our galaxy. These are stars inside our galaxy. There's also the right distance between stars in our galaxy, which is 30 trillion miles. All that distance is necessary for us to exist here on Earth. Now, 30 trillion miles. How far is 30 trillion miles? Far. Take you at least 2 tanks of gas on a Toyota Prius to go 30 trillion miles. That is, if the gas pedal doesn't stick. Now, I was out at a desert museum in Tucson, Arizona a number of years ago. If you ever go out to Tucson, outside of the city a little ways, there's a museum. But it's an outdoor museum. They also have one, you know, some things in a building. But outdoors, they'll take you outdoors at night. And since it's a pretty good way from the city lights, if it's a clear night, you can see thousands of stars in the sky. And so we're out there one night, and the guide goes, hey, it's so clear tonight. If we look up at 9:03, we're going to see the space shuttle in orbit. I said, oh, come on, we're not going to see the space shuttle in orbit. It's only 120 feet long. It's 350 miles up. We're not going to see it. Oh, me of little faith. At 9:03, the guide goes, look! And we look up in the sky, about 70 degrees above the horizon, there's an object streaking out of the west relative to us about like this. I mean, it's really cooking. When it got right about here, it disappeared. I don't know whether Scotty beamed it up or what. Actually, what happened was, despite the fact that we were in total darkness, the space shuttle was so high up that the sun was still reflecting off of it. And when it got out of the range of the sun, we couldn't see it anymore. Now, when the space shuttle was in orbit, the space shuttle was traveling at about 18,000 miles an hour. Goes around the Earth once every hour and 15 minutes. 18,000 miles an hour is 5 miles per second. You got trouble getting to work in the morning? Take the space shuttle. Here to New York in like 8 seconds. Now, I did a little calculation to try and figure out how long would it take us if we could get in the space shuttle and go from our star, the sun, to another star in our galaxy, an average distance away, 30 trillion miles. How long do you think it would take us? Going 5 miles a second to go 30 trillion miles. It would take us 201,450 years. That means if you got in the space shuttle at the time of Christ and started traveling from our star, the sun, to another star an average distance away, you'd be less than 1/100 of the way there right now. And we're going to explore space. No, we're not. We're not going anywhere in space. Who'd like to go the next nearest star? We'll go. Get in, kids. Are we almost there yet, Dad? Another 200,000 years. Play some more Xbox. Now, how many stars are out there? The number of stars that are out there are about equivalent to the number of grains of sand on all the beaches on all the Earth. And to go from one grain of sand to another grain of sand going 5 miles a second will take you over 200,000 years. See this picture here on the left? That's from the ground. You see that little square right there? That's this square from the Hubble Space Telescope. Those are stars. February 1st, 2003, President Bush goes into the East Room of the White House. It's Saturday afternoon. They turn the TV camera on. Every major network carries his address. Saturday afternoon, why? The president looks in the camera and says, "My fellow Americans, this morning, our country experienced a great tragedy. Upon re-entry into the atmosphere, the space shuttle Columbia burned up in the skies over Texas. There are no survivors. The Columbia is lost." The president then went on to quote from Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 25. Why Isaiah chapter 40? Because in Isaiah, God is speaking. And what does God say according to Isaiah? To whom will you compare me, or who is my equal, says the Holy One. In other words, you want to know what I'm like, God says? Here it is. Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these stars and named them one by one? Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. The president then looked back in the camera and said, the same God that created and named all those stars is the same God that created and knows the names of the 7 astronauts who perished today. While they did not return safely home to us, we can all now pray they've all returned safely home. You want to know who God is? Most Christians have the wrong idea of who God is. We think God is a big angel. God is not a big angel. You want to know who God is? Meditate on the attributes of God: spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent, loving, just, all-knowing. Meditate on those attributes, then remove all limits from your mind. That's God. Why is there a second commandment? Thou shalt make no graven image. At least one reason why is there a second commandment. Because any image you make of an infinite being necessarily limits his majesty. You can't draw a picture of infinity. Oh, you can draw a picture of Jesus. Why? Because Jesus had two natures. He had a divine nature and a human nature. You can draw the human nature. You can't draw the divine nature. Psalm 103, verse 11 says, God's love to those that fear him exceeds the height of the heavens above the earth. How high are the heavens above the earth? Number of stars equivalent to grains of sand on all the beaches on all the earth. Over 200,000 years between those stars at 5 miles a second. Infinite from our perspective. That's the point. Now, do you think a being that created all other things and sustains all other things, including all of those stars, might have a reason for what you're going through right now? You don't know the reason? Do you think he might? There's a lot more about God and a lot more about the evidence for God that we'll talk about tonight. And you want to know this, why? Because you don't want this happening to you, your child, or your grandchild. The evidence is there. Are we willing to accept it? We might know that it's true. Are we willing to trust in what he's provided for us? I pray that we are.